It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the Department of Energy, the DOE, and its work to strengthen tribal energy sovereignty. The Energy Department convened more than 60 tribal leaders on Capitol Hill last week for a nation-to-nation summit exploring how tribes can develop clean energy projects and make decisions about fossil fuels and their own energy resources. Join in on Energy Sovereignty, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Matt Dannenberg is here, tribal liaison for the DOE's Office of Congressional and Intergovernmental Affairs. He previously worked as an organizer and program director at the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, and he is an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Matt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, it's an honor to be here with you this morning. I've been a huge fan of the show cutting my teeth as a community organizer.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Well, let's start with the two-day Tribal Clean Energy Summit. You had hundreds of participants. You welcomed people on the second day. What were the summit's top-line takeaways?
Yeah, we have a lot of opportunities right now at the Department of Energy, and it's just a lot of information. I think that is the number one takeaway. So we have a big job to do to get the, you know, over $62 billion that was appropriated to Department of Energy on clean energy infrastructure projects out to the public, including tribal communities, as well as all the new appropriations and programs and mechanisms we have through the Inflation Reduction Act. So that was a major takeaway. We had a huge opportunity to connect everyone from the National Climate Advisor, Ali Zaidi, to DOE senior leadership with tribal leaders in interactive sessions and in a live stream public conference with PowerPoint slides, getting all that information to folks so that we can make sure we utilize all these historic dollars at this historic time.
At this historic time, because we also see oil and gas prices rising sharply. We see the pressure mounting for nations to address climate change now and right now. Can you give us your assessment? Are tribes well-positioned to meet the demand for renewable energy? Where do you see the gaps?
Yeah, I'd say tribes are not only well-positioned, but they are uniquely positioned with their special trust relationship with the federal government, as well as their special tax status. And just one example here is one of the new authorities in the Inflation Reduction Act is our Tribal Energy Loan Guarantee Program. We've made it easier to access these loans, which could cover 100% of the debt for a clean energy project for a tribe. And it extended its loan authority from $2 billion to $20 billion. So this is a game changer, and partnered with direct payments from the Department of Treasury, tribes can really start to lay the groundwork for clean energy deployment projects. I think the other major takeaway is, you know, tribes are as unique as the 574 of them all across the nation are at a different point in their energy sovereignty journey. So some are just getting started, and others are really looking at the potential of launching utility scale energy projects and being major players in the energy market.
Do tribal leaders and the federal government agree on what truly is tribal energy sovereignty? Are they on the same page?
Well, that was exactly the conversation we're looking to convene. I mean, as I was saying, energy sovereignty, I think, is just as unique to each community and each tribal nation and their own sovereignty. And so to us, energy sovereignty and what we heard during the summit is it's really a tribal nation or Alaskan villages' ability to have a choice in the power that they're consuming, they're producing, and potentially owning, and even regulating themselves. So there's so much work to be done to develop all that expertise and knowledge and to fully, you know, realize that tribal energy sovereignty. So we got our work cut out for us.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about energy needs, climate change challenges, and tribal lands, energy sovereignty with Matt Dannenberg here, tribal liaison for the Department of Energy. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Matt, it sounds like with the infrastructure law and the more recent Inflation Reduction Act that financing for energy projects is really starting to flow or be mandated because tribal energy financing can be a hurdle. How does access to capital work on tribal lands to get like a solar program financed and off the ground?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it really depends on the scale of the project. I think a great entry point and a great Wisconsin example is, and I'm not just being biased because it's my tribe, but the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa has just completed phase one of a project, the Ishkonage Nawadene solar microgrid. So this is a smaller solar project plus battery storage. And is really in response to the, you know, historic 2016 floods that took place in the Shawangan Bay region that really cut off energy and roads and infrastructure. So we needed to make sure that, as we know, these kind of flooding events are going to continue to be exacerbated by climate change, that the community is resilient, and now they have this microgrid and battery storage that can power essential services, the clinics, foodstuffs where our elders and our most vulnerable residents need to get their supplies and essential services.
That's a microgrid, but will you see projects that are linking to our country's main grid system for energy?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in terms of financing those projects, I think that utilizing the Tribal Energy Loan Guarantee Program is going to be a major avenue for tribes to get access to capital for those funds. And we are currently in talks with the Treasury, as this is a newer authority. And so we're ironing out the wrinkles in terms of how this will all work with the direct pay and also how our loans could be stacked with various clean energy tax credits to develop these projects on or off Indian lands, as long as they are a majority owned tribal business that is conducting the energy project. And I think the other major hurdle towards, you know, more of these utility scale size projects is often interconnection to the grid. So mm-hmm. is there that, transmission, distribution infrastructure, substations that would accommodate a new project. And so we do see some tribes, you know, taking advantage of, we have this major transmission line running through and working with, grid operators and their state commissions to, make plans for major utility scale solar projects and getting those online. And it's a very exciting time.
Matt Dannenberg with us, tribal liaison for the U.S. Department of Energy, as we explore the federal government's work to strengthen energy sovereignty and how it's unfolding in Indigenous communities here in Wisconsin, across the nation as well. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we discuss tribal nations, clean energy, and energy sovereignty. Here in the Midwest, more than two dozen energy-related projects are underway on tribal lands to combat climate change and boost energy independence. And that's according to the Tribal Energy Projects database. It's housed within the Department of Energy. Join in on energy sovereignty and energy projects you want to talk about. 800-642-1234. Matt Dannenberg is here, tribal liaison for the U.S. Department of Energy, and stays with us. Let's bring on John in Superior. John, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I was wondering why the reservations haven't utilized the ability to produce hemp oil. Hemp oil was originally set up to be able to be used in diesel engines because the diesel engine was designed to run on hemp oil, not a petroleum product. And the byproduct is so much cleaner. I just feel that the tribes and the reservations have the ability to produce a product now that is being federally regulated in a way that other people can't.
Alternative fuels, John, thank you. Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for the question, John. And that is not something I'm super well versed in, but you know, I've heard of, I believe, some tribes even in Michigan that are, you know, looking into hemp production and hemp byproducts. And often those are, you know, regulated and need to be approved under Department of Interior and Bureau of Indian Affairs and regulated in that sense. And so definitely something, you know, that we're exploring in all of the above, you know, approach when it comes to our energy solutions. And I think that's another key aspect of tribal energy sovereignty that, you know, it's, you know, tribes utilizing the resources that they have on their lands and ultimately, you know, the nexus with agriculture and food. And I think there's just a lot of upside in pairing energy products to agriculture and also water stewardship. So definitely some things that, you know, tribes are actually looking to and putting proposals in and getting creative about and doing that in regulatory environments in their states and with other agencies.
Certainly the legacy of extractive energy production on tribal lands, that's been controversial between First Nations and the U.S. government. I mean, tribes take different approaches to gas and oil and coal production. What can First Nations and the U.S. government learn from each other's approaches?
Kate, that's the biggest question on my mind right now. It's what keeps me up at night. And, you know, as a Battle River tribal member, I had a lot of experience with the history in Wisconsin here in recent history with the iron ore taconite project that was proposed and a lot of the changes to Wisconsin's mining permitting laws. And that is something that is being evaluated right now. And we've had tribal consultation on in an interagency working group working on at the federal government right now in terms of permitting and mining reform. And we know that a major aspect of combating the climate crisis is decarbonizing our transportation sector and transitioning to electric vehicles and alternative fuel vehicles. And that the batteries for those are often, you know, contain really crucial, critical minerals such as nickel, cobalt, and of course, lithium, which has also been a bit of a hot button issue. And so there are a lot of conversations happening right now with, you know, tribes across the North America and those that have had a lot of experience in sourcing these. And how do we, you know, all come together and have a path that is just and equitable for tribes and not putting them on the front lines of this again and providing assurances that we're going to do things the right way in an effort to combat climate.
And considering tribal nations control more than 50 million acres of land in the U.S., another hot button issue there is Enbridge. And, you know, a federal judge ruled Canadian energy company Enbridge guilty of trespassing by continuing to operate its Line 5 oil and gas pipeline across the Bad River Reservation. The judge had stopped short of ordering the pipeline to shut down, a stop by the tribe. So how does the Energy Department handle pipeline disputes like that involving tribes?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Kate. And, you know, first and foremost, it's, you know, it's understanding the history, first and foremost, and then early consultation. And so making sure that we're in touch with tribal leaders about, you know, projects, whether they're changing or expanding or being rerouted, and making sure that we're, you know, hearing from tribal leaders first and foremost about what their desires are as a sovereign nation, and taking that into account as we're making decisions on what to do in terms of pipeline permitting, which is handled by another agency. But of course, it's an all government approach to these really complex and controversial topics.
Talking about energy and climate change with Matt Dannenberg, tribal liaison for the Federal Department of Energy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we look at energy sovereignty and what it means. Let's go to Alan in Athens. Alan, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I've been interested in energy independence for literally decades. My background's pharmaceuticals, but I kind of consider myself, not kind of, I'm an inventor. And I wanted to get the guest's name clearly and offer the possibility of a conversation about a planned community built around energy independence, but also food independence.
Alan, thank you. So, Matt, certainly elevating this, as you said, the nexus of so many different things, whether it's energy, food, and other health systems, perhaps all part of the energy sovereignty formula, if you will.
Yeah, I have an open door and happy to share, my email address with folks, especially those that have innovative ideas in tribal energy sovereignty and that nexus. And so, yeah, Matthew, dot Dannenberg at hq.doe.gov. Happy to have conversations with folks and entertain any big ideas, because as you're saying, now is the time to really be catalyzing these ideas and funding them, because we're at a pivotal point in the climate crisis. And what I'm really excited and wanted to talk about for a minute, Kate, is next Monday. I'm going to be speaking at a great convening by the Wisconsin Academy of Arts and Sciences, their Climate Fast Forward conference, which is really going to be, building off of and taking ideas like this from the caller, and building off of Wisconsin's clean energy plan, as well as some past convenings to look at what are the action steps now that the state can do in order to take action on climate moving forward. So convening, really big thought leaders from all over the state, and they're really incorporating traditional ecological knowledge, which is, something we're also really working diligently on at the federal government. So just really excited for that convening and the Wisconsin Academy event happening in Madison next week. And encourage folks to register and participate in that event at wisconsinacademy.org and tune
Lots
in,
of
'cause
conversations around. Yes. So, as you became Department of Energy's tribal liaison this year, you're working across all offices within the agency. What do you want to accomplish in the job?
The legacy I'd ultimately like to leave is a tribal consultation strategy and institutionalized ability for all those offices to be interacting with tribes better than I found it. And so that is looking at all the best practices across the federal government and making sure that all of our offices at DOE are working with tribes, building those relationships with tribes to make sure that their funding is getting to tribal communities. And so how are we building up the staff capacity in DOE to support tribes and train them so that they're astute and the special trust relationship? And then how do we ultimately advance tribes in their energy sovereignty journey, and what does that actual roadmap look like? So there is so many technical assistance opportunities at the department, and making sure that those are all really clear for tribes and that we're assisting them onward in their energy sovereignty journey is my ultimate goal.
We only have a few seconds left, but what would be your message to First Nations here in Wisconsin as they want to work with the Department of Energy and Projects?
Reach out to me. I'm the front door, and we'll get you to the right folks within the Department of Energy. If you've applied before and haven't gotten an award or a grant, don't be discouraged. We are, reevaluating how to make those simpler. And so keep applying, partner up with folks and tribes that have had successful projects, and I'm here to help be a guide in the process.
Matt, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Matt Dannenberg is tribal liaison for the Federal Department of Energy's Office of Congressional and Intergovernmental Affairs. He's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it ended access to virtually all abortions in Wisconsin. And since then, the state has seen protests, campaign ads, and new political groups aimed at organizing the people who believe the state's 1849 abortion ban is too restrictive. But in a closely divided swing state, the future of that law could come down to a relatively small number of undecided voters. Rob Mentzer reports.
For Democrats running for office this year, the calculation is simple. They believe their position on abortion rights is popular, and the Republican Party's anti-abortion views are unpopular. In the race for governor, Democrat Tony Evers has launched new ads that say Republican Tim Michaels would force a 12-year-old who is raped to give birth. It's a likely reference to Michaels' position when he ran for U.S. Senate in 2004. Michaels was asked then about such a scenario on WPR's regional talk show Route 51. He began by saying he couldn't think of a worse crime than the rape of a 12-year-old.
But I think in the end, what I would try and tell them is, you know, there's a life in there, a life that was created by God. And if you carry that baby full term, there'll be 25 or 35 couples that will be there willing and ready to adopt that baby and love it and raise it as their own.
Michael's 2004 answer is a marker of how deeply held his anti-abortion views are. But 2022 is a different world than 2004. Then abortion was legal in Wisconsin. The example was hypothetical. Neither of those things is true anymore. Late last month, Michaels changed his position, saying he would not veto a bill that added exceptions for rape and incest to Wisconsin's abortion ban. A Michaels campaign spokesperson pointed to the candidate's recent statements and said the WPR appearance was nearly 20 years old. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June to overturn the right to abortion access was a generational victory for conservatives, but politically, it seems to have helped Democrats. The Marquette University Law School poll found more than 80% of Wisconsin voters believe rape and incest exceptions should be allowed. About 60% of voters and two-thirds of independent voters say Roe v. Wade should never have been overturned.
It's fine for 50 years, and then you wake up one morning, and now it's not legal.
That's Jill Reesley. The 71-year-old from Cudahy identifies as an independent, and she's voted for Republicans in the past, not this year.
If any woman in this state votes Republican, they are totally out of their minds.
Reesley was one of more than 100 Wisconsin voters who told WPR's Wisconsin Main Street Agenda Project that abortion was her most important voting issue in the midterms. WPR interviewed five women who said they were politically independent or who leaned Republican.
The government should not be involved. I don't want a politician making decisions that I should be making with my healthcare provider.
More than just abortion being medical care, it's also about people having the right to make their own choices in their lives.
I actually feel ashamed that we let our young women down.
That was Jean Bartz of Baraboo, Michelle Johnson of Sullivan, and Mary Fuller of Appleton. None of them identifies herself as a Democrat, but they all say this is the issue that will decide their votes this year. Mary Kate Lazotte is a political scientist at Augusta University in Georgia. She studies gender gaps in politics. She says abortion is not one of the issues where there's a pronounced difference between women's and men's views. But
Republicans in general are much more likely than Democrats to disagree with their party on abortion, on overturning Roe.
And that's why Lazat thinks women who hold somewhat conflicted views on the issue really could reshape the electorate.
Even if they don't identify as pro-choice or have always identified as weakly pro-life, there's a lot of people who are not going to be in favor of a complete lack of access.
Wisconsin is a closely divided state, and races for governor and U.S. Senate are tightly contested. Most voters say inflation and economic concerns are more important to them than abortion rights. But for Democrats, the state's political future may hinge on whether abortion is the issue that can make independent voters swing their way. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we meet the podcasters behind Uprooted, the new podcast from WPR Reports that gives voice to some of the lived experiences of the 15,000 Cubans who were sent to Fort McCoy in 1980 during the Castro regime. Join in with your stories, your questions on this mass emigration of the Mariel Boatlift, 800-642-1234. WPR's Maureen McCollum is executive producer and co-host of Uprooted. Maureen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
And we also have your other co-host, Omar Granados, here, producer and co-host of the podcast. He is a UW La Crosse Associate Professor in Global Cultures and Languages. Omar, welcome to you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Omar, let's start with you first. Having grown up in Havana, Cuba, what does this storytelling project, this podcast, mean to you?
It's a story of, you know, thinking about home and where home is and what it means to, you know, migrate and what it means to belong into a place. For many immigrants and people that have had to, leave their land for any sort of circumstance, whether it's political or economic, we're hoping that this podcast, you know, tells a story that they can relate to. And we're also helping others, you know, people in Wisconsin to understand how to listen to the stories and how to start thinking about what we can learn from these migrant communities. When I was 5 years old, the Mariel Boatlift happened in Cuba, and I never expected that, you know, 42 years later, I would be doing a podcast on a Mariel refugee community in a place like La Crosse, Wisconsin. So it's been a tremendous experience for me.
Maureen, help us understand a little bit more about the history and what you found fascinating as you dug into these untold stories from Cubans migrating and living in Wisconsin.
Right. Back when I was a college student in La Crosse, I went to UW La Crosse. I had heard that almost 15,000 Cuban refugees had been sent to Fort McCoy during the Mariel Boatlift as they waited, you know, to either move in with family or to find sponsors in the U.S. And I've always been interested in stories about migration. I was a Spanish major. So I wanted to learn more. And what I found was that over the years, like, you didn't hear many stories about what it was like for the Cuban refugees who remained in specifically southern Wisconsin and the La Crosse area. And so I just wanted to know, what was it like being essentially sent to a state that none of them knew what Wisconsin was once they arrived in the United States? So why did they decide to stay here? What has life been like ever since? And what do they dream of for their futures? And that's what we really try to get to the heart of in this podcast.
And you really dig into archival material. You found this recording of an NPR story that aired on All Things Considered in September of 1980. And the story profiles the radio station and musicians at Fort McCoy.
It is mostly salsa music, but there are occasional songs from the Rolling Stones, the Bee Gees, John Coltrane, Louis Armstrong, or from the refugees' own musical group, formed at Fort McCoy and recorded in the studios of WRPC.
Maureen, what did you learn from these archives and these other news reports?
Well, big thanks to NPR's Research Archives and Data Strategy team for helping us find all this audio. All this archival audio really helps the story come to life. And I think from a listening standpoint, really helps transport us back to 1980 and just understand better what it was like to live through this moment. But just hearing these stories, it's interesting because the Mariel boat lift and the Cuban refugees coming to Wisconsin was covered really well back in 1980, in the sense that like there was a good amount of coverage. You know, the newspapers were covering it. National media was coming in. How it was covered is a different story, and it's something that we dive into the podcast, you know, when it comes to how fairly people's stories are brought to the forefront. But, you know, in the 40 years since then, there really haven't been a ton of stories out there just regarding what life has been like. So it's been nice to just hear, you know, how the story was presented back then, how the framing was portrayed, and, you know, thinking about how that media coverage really impacted their lives throughout the decades.
Omar, along the music thread, you talked with Osvaldo Durruti of Madison, who passed the time at Fort McCoy by joining one of the bands there.
There was a group, musician. We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know. I just want to get away, you know. You're going to meet people, new faces, Americans, and, you know.
Music was the way out of that environment. What meaning did that have to these people at Fort McCoy in a totally different land and place?
One of the things that the podcast does is that it's really, you know, open a window into life inside the camp in many ways. The relationships that refugees develop with each other, with camp personnel, army personnel. The story of the Mariel boat lift has been extremely well documented, except for the segment that we're dealing with here in our podcast, which is precisely what happened inside the four camps that were opened during that period in 1980. So there's a lot of waiting, and then there's a lot of people waiting. What we discovered is that, you know, in a way, these refugees are trying to continue a way of life that they were forced to leave behind. So, of course, music plays a big part of it. We have stories about refugees joining in the kitchen team, cooking Cuban recipes with army personnel, which, of course, didn't know anything about Cuban food at the time. The stories of neighbors who donated religious items to the refugees. We have artists that were there was a community of artists painting and producing sculptures and other artifacts inside the camp who are now part of a collection of art that a historian in La Crosse owns. So people got married there. There was a baby born at the base on 4th of July. So there's a whole world of relationships that continues a way of life within the base that we really dive into. And of course, this is all in the context of waiting for a sponsor to appear, because this is the only way to get out of the base is by being sponsored by an American citizen or an American, you know, nonprofit organization. So it takes a lot of waiting, and of course when you're waiting you need to entertain yourself.
Patience and hope and keeping those spirits alive. Music, one of those avenues. Omar Granados, Maureen McCollum here, co-hosts of the podcast Uprooted from WPR reports as we explore these untold stories of the massive movement of Cubans who fled to the U.S. in 1980, some of them landing at Fort McCoy. Join in on this history with your stories, your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the hosts behind the new WPR podcast, Uprooted. Maureen McCollum and Omar Granados, they weave together the stories of Cuban refugees in 1980 who fled Fidel Castro's communist regime, searched for a better life in the U.S., sought to be reunited with family or were pushed out of prisons. They landed on boats in South Florida, and nearly 15,000 taken to Fort McCoy, the resettlement camp in Wisconsin. Join in on this history, what you remember, 1980, 800-642-1234. Maureen and Omar, stay with us. Want to hear some more tape here. You talked with Cubans who crossed the Florida Straits on these small fishing boats. And here's the voice of Ernesto Rodriguez of La Crosse.
A lot of boats sink, people drown.
How did you feel?
Scared. See the big wave. The boat was top like this. When it was going down like this, it was... And people scared. People get sick. Everybody.
Maureen, I can't help but think of the migrant crisis today and how deadly these sea journeys are, crossing like the Mediterranean to start new lives in Europe, or refugees fleeing war in Iraq or Syria. What parallels do you see based on what these 1980 Cuba refugees told you?
Well, I mean, when they've shared the stories about the journey across the Florida Straits, it's just it's horrifying to me, because it sounds so scary. And when you think about what people go through in order to, you know, try to find a better life, it can really get to you when you just hear firsthand accounts about what it was like to make that trip. And, you know, it's interesting because once they got to Florida, they arrived and there was a lot of mixed emotions there. Like Erne, who we just heard from, he tells a story about when he landed on shore, he kissed the ground and then he was immediately given apples, and he had only had an apple one time in his life. So, you know, you're going through this moment where it's like complete trauma as you're crossing the sea, to complete jubilation, to, I think he says, like maybe 12 hours later, he was put on a plane, sent to Fort McCoy. And so then there's just this complete confusion. So when you just think about this very short amount of time and how much happened to him and some of the other people we talk with on this podcast, it's really incredible. And then, you know, 40 years later, all the impacts and the things that have happened in their lives ever since then, it doesn't necessarily get easy for them. So that's one thing that we really dig into within this podcast.
Omar, what came up for you as you heard the descriptions of these boat journeys across the Florida Straits?
I think what Maureen just described is a very accurate, way of thinking about the way the Mariupol lived, probably felt for many of the people that were joining in. And I think also the idea of how much happened in a short period of time. I mean, the Mariupol lift only took place over, 3.5 months. Mm-hmm. But we have 125,000 people that really don't have much to the side in that time. So folks like Ernesto and Nino, who is another of the Cuban refugees we feature, they were sitting in a prison cell when somebody came to get them. And, these were young men at the time. And they said, do you want to stay in prison for another 40 years or do you want to go to the United States? Mm. And they wouldn't even believe the person who came to see tell them this. Don't joke with me is the response that we get from Nino in the podcast. So in a matter of, you know, 24 hours, they're in a boat, and in a matter of, you know, 48 hours, they're in a fort, a military base in Fort McCoy. I don't think when we talk about migration, you know, there's some planning involved. There is some idea that you want to leave. There is some, you know, preparation that takes place. You know, or at some point you foresee a major crisis coming into your society, into your homeland, and you're thinking, well, maybe I should migrate or I should try to escape. But this was a very sudden series of events that didn't, you know, was caused by the breaking into the Peruvian embassy in Havana. It was you know, inflamed by the discourse of the Cuban Revolution, mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden you find yourself in the middle of a place where you just didn't even know it existed. So you didn't really have a lot of time to think about that, and I think that's what going into these stories of military detention, that's the message that I've taken as a researcher. You know, how much was decided or not in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We had a listener call in who says that they used to work on freight trains that ran through Fort McCoy back in the 80s when Cuban residents were significantly high at Fort McCoy, and some would hop the train to go south or to go east without a sponsor. Maureen, did you come across any of those recollections or any stories like that?
Yeah, we talk with at least one person, Armando, in this podcast, who was 16 when he was sent to Fort McCoy. He was among a group of miners who was living there, and he talked about hopping the fence at one point. He got caught right away, and he said he never tried to hop the fence again. But, you know, we've come across newspaper articles, and Omar's talked with people who have hopped the fence and experience some pretty intensive, you have some accounts of people being placed in solitary confinement for long periods of time and just getting in a lot of trouble for doing that.
We only have a few seconds left, but I was really surprised about their intake and the paperwork they encountered at Fort McCoy and volunteers who are doing this. Omar, can you give us a little sense of that?
There was a lot of mess. It was a very messy situation. You know, it was FEMA at the time and a number of other organizations, federal agencies involved in the intake process. But the one of the main problems was language, of course. There were all sorts of errors in translation and data collection and the obstacle that also the Cuban government had not shared any records with the United States about, you know, criminal records or medical records or so, a lot of the people that were working at the base in this processing and translation were high school and college students. And we feature stories and interviews with some of them in the podcast as well.
Well, thank you. And we're out of time, but thank you both for joining us. Maureen McCollum, executive producer and co-host of Uprooted. Omar Granados, producer and co-host as well. Wisconsin's-